I don't want no oil spoiling my shoreline. I like fish much better than crud. I like birds and things a-creeping and crawling. Won't trade no more oil for blood. The sun done give us all we need to make this country run. But that black demon oil's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. I don't want them nukes run by them kooks who think radioactivity is fun. No more three-headed frogs or kids with leukemia. Nuclear power ain't fit for a dog. The sun don't give us all we need to make this country run. But that nuclear power's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. No nukes!
Good morning, Toledo, and good afternoon, Columbus, and hello to those of you listening on the internet, wherever and whenever you are. Oh, and good morning, Bowling Green, also. My name is Joe DeMar, and I'm here, quote unquote, with my incredible co-host,
Rebecca Wood.
Yes, and together, Rebecca and I are about to craft an hour of radio called For a Green Future.
Sorry, I have to periodically reassure the dog that everything's okay.
Oh, okay, yes, you've got a canine co-host there. For a Green Future is a show where we talk about ecology and the environment, and we talk about it in the ways that it affects you, your wealth, your health, your happiness, and the wealth and health and happiness of your friends and your families and the pets and the critters, the annelids and the invertebrates and the vertebrates and pretty much everybody and everything, because we are all wrapped up together here on this wonderful planet called Earth. And we've got a good show lined up for you today. No guest this week. We're constantly looking for guests, and sometimes they just don't, we don't manage to get one in time. Already got next week's guest lined up, so that's good. So what we're going to do instead, well, first we're going to talk, just us folks, for about another 10 minutes or so. And then we're going to have, we're going to go over Nature Magazine's top 10 people of 2023, because most of them have some sort of ecological connection, because Nature is a magazine about science, and science and ecology are connected, like, you know, intricately there. And interestingly, one of the top 10 people in Nature's list is actually not a person. So that'll be something interesting. Then we will hear from our patrons and sponsors, to whom we are incredibly grateful. And then Rebecca, and what will you be talking about this week, Rebecca?
I have chocolate and also maple syrup.
Chocolate and maple syrup. Yeah, there you go. There's some definite connections to the natural world there.
Sweet and also sticky.
Then we have ecological news, and that will be our show. I wanted to start out talking a little bit about forests. Just remind people that there's a whole bunch of different types of forests. We got your tropical rainforest, mangrove forest, monsoon forest, scrub forests, temperate forests, rainforest, chaparral, deciduous, and boreal forests. Now,
wow.
And so there's forests all over the world, and one of the most heavily forested countries, believe it or not, is Japan. They are actually,
wow,
yeah, they are 67.2% forested. Canada, I believe, is the most forested country in the world, which is not too surprising given that it's huge and empty. But the reason I wanted to bring up Japan specifically is because I discovered just this past week of last week we had Vina Kali on, and Vina Kali was talking about the nuclear radiation that's contaminated the area around Piketon, Ohio. And it just got me to thinking about the idea of sacrifice zones. Japan is mostly forested, but in terms of the planet, Japanese industry actually is responsible for a lot of deforestation all over the rest of the world. And so they're kind of willing to sacrifice other countries' forests for their industrial processes, even though they do protect their own forests. You know, it's just this kind of concept, this idea that you could sacrifice that area over there as long as this area here that we're in is still okay. And of course, ecologically speaking, that is a little bit ridiculous because there literally is no over there. That's one of the main lessons of ecology, is that we're all right here on this one planet and everything is interconnected. So all these sacrifice zones around the world are just sort of temporarily sacrificed, you know, separate, because one thing about them, as we heard from Veena Kali last week, is the contamination from that sacrifice zone is spreading. And I found out that there's a place in Japan called Aomori, which had the Rokkasho nuclear waste recycling plant, kind of just like Piketon. And there, they have at that area the highest death rate in the whole country of Japan.
Just out of curiosity, this doesn't have anything to do with the Fernald plant, does it? Or the Fernald facility?
Well, Fernald's another contaminated area. It's another one of these sacrifice zones, and they're all over the world. The one in Aomori in Japan, they released 2,150 million or trillion, excuse me, becquerels of tritium from 2006 to 2009. And as we know, tritium is radioactively active for about 120 years. And so, you know, that tritium is still, you know, busily causing cancer and early deaths in those people in that region. Fernald also has contamination. Of course, we all know about Chernobyl, you know, that huge sacrifice zone. That's probably one of the most famous sacrifice zones in the world. But there's lots of others. We've talked about Hanford in Washington State, which is considered actually to be one of the most contaminated, radioactively contaminated places in the world. But there's another place that we talked about occasionally called Sellafield over in the UK, which is competing with Hanford. The contamination levels there are just incredible because, again, that was a nuclear waste reprocessing area where they separated out plutonium from the nuclear waste from the nuclear rods from nuclear power plants. And they were horribly successful because sitting in Sellafield are tons and tons of plutonium, which no one has any idea what to do with. So they're just sitting there radiating. But the process of separating out the plutonium created this sacrifice zone that, you know, the especially the seashore around the Sellafield plant. And the Sellafield's a huge sacrifice area, thousands and thousands of acres. And the seashore around there, they've tested sediments and they're just intensely radioactive. So, but probably one of the first ones and one of the places that created this whole idea of the whole phrase sacrifice zone is called the Polygon in Kazakhstan. And that was a place where the Soviet Union tested their nuclear weapons, and they exploded something like 250 nuclear bombs in this remote area in Kazakhstan, which is now, it's uninhabitable in that the levels of radiation are so high that people who would live there won't live very long, but people are actually still living there. So So essentially, the idea that you could sacrifice a bunch of people in an area, whether it's for the nuclear industry or the chemical industry, there's chemical sacrifice zones like Cancer Alley down in Louisiana. Mining, of course, has huge, incredible sacrifice zones. The tar sands up in Canada is a that sacrifice zone is huge enough to be seen from the International Space Station. Deforestation causes sacrifice zones, especially in places like rainforest, where once you cut down the forest, the ground is so thin and the rain comes and washes away what little topsoil there is, and you essentially get an un, you know, you get a desert, and so that is also a sacrifice zone. So the I just wanted to sort of remind everybody, just sort of talk about this idea and this way of thinking that you can we can be okay here, even as they destroy the environment over there. And unfortunately, that's just not true. Because eventually the consequences of creating these sacrifice zones become global. They become worldwide. And we actually have a couple stories in the ecological news segment that talk about that. So, just a quick discussion about sacrifice zones. And I
Yeah,
think.
that's got three words for you, people: wind and water.
Exactly. That
They're the planet's circulatory system, and they circulate stuff.
right. Yeah, and as Vida told us last week, the contamination from the Piketon plant has been found in air monitors 14 miles away from the
Good.
original plant. And the school building that had to be abandoned because it's radioactively contaminated down there, that was also about 15 miles from the plant. So like I say, having a little separate zone that you sacrifice doesn't last long because that contamination does spread out. Now, some people also have the erroneous idea that once you dilute stuff down to a certain point, they don't affect you anymore. And with the case of radioactivity, that just simply isn't true because we found that even the lowest levels of radiation have very high, health effects. They cause cancer at a very high rate. So really all diluting does in terms of radioactivity is spread out the spread out the destruction. You know, it doesn't get rid of the destruction. It just sort of moves it around and there is this past week there was a huge story that downstream from Fukushima, whereas we've been reporting, they've been releasing radioactive tritium into the Pacific. They had a huge die-off of the fish. Millions and millions of tons of fish have just been washing up on the shore downstream from Fukushima. And we don't know that what's caused that die-off. I mean, it's unprecedented in terms of the local people have never seen a die-off like this before. The official story is that it could be water currents bringing cold water in, or hot water, or it could be some kind of deoxygenation event. But they're not checking to see if maybe some of these fish were suffering from exposure to radioactivity. They're not testing for the radioactivity. And so all the guesses, until you test, until you actually have hard data, all the guesses are literally just that, guesses. And so at this point, I would say we can't rule out the radiation dumped by Fukushima, especially since all the studies have shown that that radiation isn't just tritium, that there are other radioactive elements that got out into that water too.
The thing is, normally you would want to know why if a lot of fish were dying, because whatever the reason, it's not good, you know, even
Right.
if it is just a lack of oxygen or some cold, hot or cold water or something.
Yeah, what I've and all the news stories I've seen, they asked a couple marine biologists to make guesses, and they make guesses, but I haven't seen any sign. None of the news articles I've read have said that anybody's actually like testing these fish and trying to figure out why they died. And the answer also could simply be that the Japanese government doesn't want to find out that it was, in fact, that radiation is a factor in what happened. So that's an old trick. You don't find anything if you don't look for it. So we'll keep an eye on that story, and if any more information comes in, we'll let you know. Okay, so now on to some other stuff, an interesting little thing. Yeah, Nature Magazine's one of the best magazines in the world in terms of reporting on science. And they do a lot of stories on ecology, and they're one of the resources I like to go to when I want some really reliable information, because it's all very carefully reviewed by scientists. It's peer reviewed, and if you can get an article published in Nature, you've met a very high standard. And for the past 10 years, Nature, every December, they do their top 10 people who contributed to science in the previous year. And so we're going to take a quick look at them. One, first off, and so what I'm going to do, we don't have time to go through all 10 of them in detail. So what I'm going to do is just mention the ones that aren't ecologically connected, but then I'll go into more detail on the ones that are ecologically important. So one of their top 10, the first one was a woman named Kalpana Kalahasti, and she was listed because she's an engineer and she's a manager, and she ran the Indian space program that just landed a lander, the Chandrayaan 3 touchdown on the moon. And so that's India is now the fourth country in the world that landed something on the moon, and it was largely thanks to this woman, Kalpana Kalahasti. Now, this next one is extremely environmentally important, and her name is Marina Silva, and she's in Brazil, and she's Brazil's Minister of Environment. And so when Lula, when da Silva got elected this past year, he immediately appointed her because she had been his Minister of Environment during his first term, and she has definitely had a huge impact reining in the deforestation of the Brazilian rainforest. And basically what happened was that the previous Prime Minister Bolsonaro, he dismantled all the protections that the Silva had put in place, and logging z went up 60% under Bolsonaro. But in just a few months, just from January of this year to July of this year, there's been a 43% drop in deforestation alerts in Brazil. So she's already had a huge impact. And one interesting thing they gave a little bit of her biography is that what she became an environmentalist after meeting Chico Mendes. And Chico Mendes was a very incredibly important environmental activist, and he was murdered back in 1988 by a rancher. So he's one of our environmental martyrs. And so he set her on a course of pursuing leadership roles, political leadership, in order to save the environment. And so she's been doing environmental activism since the 1970s. Then she got into politics to in order to pursue environmental policies. She became Brazil's youngest senator in 1994 when she was 35 years old. And she took the opportunity of getting this, being picked as one of the nature's top 10 to talk about CO2 emissions, because essentially she said, everything I'm doing with the Brazilian rainforest will mean nothing if we keep putting CO2 in the air, because it'll destroy the forest even if I stop the deforestation. So she thinks of herself, there's a tree in the Amazon that produces a very strong fiber that the indigenous people use to and they use it in all their crafts. They use it to make their canoes and their buildings. And she sees herself as one of the fibers from that tree. And her quote is, "This is how I see my work, bringing together those who are available and whatever is necessary to form a support surface in the challenging journeys of our time." So that's a cool one, Marina Silva. Happy to hear from her. Katsuhiko Hayashi is he's a biologist, a microbiologist, and the reason he's in there is he's figured out how to turn male cells into viable eggs that can be fertilized. And so basically what he's done is so far with mice is he's created mice that have two fathers and no mother, which is kind of interesting. One interesting aspect of this is that he's looking to use this to save species that are down to just a couple individuals. So he actually, right now, his laboratory is working on the white rhino, because there's only two northern northern white rhinos left in the world. And unfortunately, those they're both female.
There are quite a few right winos left.
Yeah, no shortage of them. That's true. And they seem to be reproducing just fine. But so it's possible that he'll be able to create new cell lines that can then be grown into new white rhinos. But it's much better to not have to go that route. Okay, another interesting person is Anna Critcher, and she's a U.S. physicist, and she basically helped the National Ignition Facility produce nuclear reactions. Fusion's that always 20 years off thing. It's been 20 years off since the 1950s. We may never need fusion, if we put wind and solar in, and conservation and geothermal. We might not need this. The idea of boundless energy, because that was the original promise of nuclear fission too, that there'd just be so much energy, more than we could ever possibly do use. And that this is true with fusion too. They're promising us, incredible power. And I think, ecologically speaking, that's kind of a primitive way of thinking. I mean, instead of having more power than we could ever possibly use. So it's great this woman scientist is helping with fusion, but the whole pursuit of fusion itself is a little problematic. But on to Alani Mirovili, and she is not problematic at all. In fact, she's the United Nations Chief Heat Officer, and basically, she's helping protect the world from the threats of climate change. And specifically, her whole career has been working on making cities and Athens, in particular, Athens, Greece, able to better withstand climate change by planting trees and changing the layouts of buildings and basically doing the things that protect people in the cities from the heat of the cities. And so, yeah, she recently, just before she got appointed to this position in the United Nations, this past year, she was watched. She personally saw the forest fires in Greece that we reported on. And she said, this is the type of devastation you can't really replace. And this is clearly a catastrophe that we're responsible for. So what happened to her is she saw a big forest fires in 2007. And then she went on to head the Parks Department in Athens, Greece, and she used that to plant thousands and thousands of trees. She, like many environmentalists, is also concerned about the problem of air conditioning because as heat goes up, more and more people start air conditioning. And that, of course, increases the demand for energy, which can produce more greenhouse gases and create that like positive feedback loop. I remember there was a heat wave way back in the Clinton administration down in Texas, and people were actually dying by the thousands. And so what Clinton did was he used federal funds and he bought, tens of thousands of air conditioners and shipped them to Dallas. And I was thinking, yeah, it's good for the moment, but actually that would kind of make the problem worse in the long run. But so even though she can't, doesn't like air conditioners, she actually had to buy one this past summer because it got so hot in Greece, just as it's getting so hot in places like India, that literally having an air conditioning is a matter of life and death. So, but she's a great gal to have in that position in the United Nations. Next, James Hamlin, superconductivity. He's a physicist that he debunked the claims of room temperature superconductivity that some scientists were trying to get by. Svetlana Majsov, she's the scientist who created the science behind the weight loss drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy. I don't know if any of you are using those, but these drugs work by suppressing people's appetites, and that actually can have some ecological benefit because, if we eat less, particularly if we eat less meat, we reduce agriculture's impact on the environment. Let's see, then the last couple, Halido Tinto, he's a fellow who has come up with a vaccine for malaria, and which is a great thing, because malaria, there's 200 million cases of malaria in Africa every year, and about 500,000 people die from it every year in Africa. It's a little bit of a mixed bag, ecologically speaking, because one of the effects of malaria has been to keep people out of certain areas in terms of it's protected. Places that have high malaria have been protected from overdevelopment because people don't like to live there because they might get malaria. So if we ever come up with a completely effective malaria vaccine, it could and mean the end of some of the last wild places in Africa. So hopefully we'll be able to figure that out before then. But one of the things that this does demonstrate is that all the natural limits on humans, on our population growth, on our spreading out on the planet, this past two centuries, the story has been us overcoming all those natural limits. And so it's not too surprising if we finally beat malaria too. But right now, his vaccine is 20% effective, and they're working now. We're about to release one. I believe that's 40% effective, so it's still not 100%, but But an important development. Fellow named Thomas Powles, he was a cancer researcher. He came up with a good treatment for bladder cancer. And then the 10th, the last of the nature's top 10 is ChatGPT. They chose ChatGPT as one of their top 10 because of the way AI software is changing everything. And it's kind of an interesting question, and it has actually direct application right now because we just learned that Microsoft is using chat or using AI to fill out the paperwork for their new small modular reactors with with the NRC. And if you're familiar with AI, you know that one of the big problems with it is that it could be completely wrong and put those completely wrong things out just as confidently and just as if they were completely right, because AI actually has no idea whether it's right or wrong. It has no actual connection to reality. All it does is take words and mix them up into like a word salad and serve it to people. So,
Garbage in, garbage out, as they say.
right. And it can cause all kinds of problems. If the data going into an AI has bias, then the information coming out will have bias. If the data going in, and it just makes plausible sounding sentences. That's all AI does. And so to have AI filling out the details of a nuclear power plant application could potentially be disastrous. And I'm hoping the NRC wises up to this and actually makes a regulation against using AI to fill these things out, because they've got to be right. AI, if you ask AI questions, like simple math questions on like compounding interest and stuff, it can give you a completely wrong answer. And so to do that with a nuclear power plant, if they start using these papers that the AI has generated to build their nuclear plant, it could melt down, just
Oh
frankly.
boy.
Yeah. All right. So that's all I wanted to talk about in the first part of the show. And so now let's hear from our advertisers and patrons. For a Green Future is brought to you by our patrons. These are wonderful people who've gone to patreon.com. That's Patreon. There they searched for a Green Future. Up popped our wonderful Patreon page that shows different levels of memberships and has a bunch of cool photos on it. There they picked the level of membership that matched their monthly budget, and every month a little bit comes out of their account, comes over to us, and that's how we could afford to keep this show on the air. So we are extremely grateful to our patrons, and if you want to become one, just go to patreon.com and search for a Green Future. Thank you.
For a Green Future is also brought to you by the Wood County Park District. The Wood County Park District is a natural resources conservation agency. They protect natural spaces, maintain quality green spaces, provide engaging programming, and they teach people to love and respect nature. They also restore wildlife habitats and lead people on outdoor adventures. Wood County Parks protects natural spaces in Wood County for all to enjoy from 8 a.m. to 30 minutes past sunset every day of the year. There are several ways to get a hold of them and find out what's happening. One is to call them at 419-353-1897. Another is to visit their website, www.wcparks.org. The website again is www.wcparks.org. They are also available on all social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and many others. Just search for WC Parks. That's the Wood County Park District, and we're very grateful for their support.
Thanks again to our advertisers and patrons. And so, Rebecca, now it's your turn. Let's talk about sweet stuff.
Alrighty, well, coming up this weekend, as a matter of fact, on Saturday we are having National Chocolate Covered Anything Day, and then Sunday is National Maple Syrup Day. Just right in time for Christmas, which is all about, if there was a peppermint day on Monday, it'd be perfect, but there isn't. So yeah, National. So I just had your chocolate. Chocolate is made from coca beans, or which are actually seed kernels. They're obviously not actual legumes. They look like beans, though, which are dried and fermented. They come from the cacao tree, also called the Thermobroma cacao, which is a 15 to 26-foot tall evergreen tree. Didn't know that. It's not like a pine tree, I don't think, but that's very interesting. I did not know that. And first, they were first used as food by the Olmecs that we know of in the 19th to 11th century BCE. Reached Europe in the 1500s.
I was going to say, well, Olmecs are in South America, right?
Yeah, Mexico, I think. Pretty much Mexico.
Okay.
I could be. I think they're in the Nahuatl language group. I'm not really sure, but yeah, it's used in liquid, solid, or paste form, and they do this by first fermenting it, then drying, cleaning, and roasting the beans, shelling them to reveal something called nibs, chocolate nibs, which are ground to make cocoa mass, and then liquefied by heating to produce chocolate liqueur, I guess. And that can be cooled and processed into cocoa solids and cocoa butter. So yeah, ecological issues, there are a lot. According to somebody called the Good Chocolatier website, their cacao palm plantations are linked to deforestation and climate change, because trees, animals, and other plants are eliminated for the space to grow the trees, the soil and the nutrients, the water's diverted for the cacao trees, and all this causes erosion, sediment and waterways. Now, the Good Chocolatier makes their living selling chocolate, so they seem to feel that sustainable practices can solve all this, or what, at least help. I'm not sure how impeccable a source they are. They might have a vested interest in the idea that it is fixable by good management practices. But according to them, something called both rising demand and something called black pod rot have forced farmers to abandon a lot of more sustainable practices like shade growing. Traditionally, cacao trees have always been shade grown. And they're doing a lot of stuff like adding extra pesticides and, cl clearing out more weeds and, getting them out in the sunshine to promote faster growth, but it's not really sustainable. It uses everything up and leads to more soil contamination and herbicide resistance and stuff. Apparently, most of these, the two major areas for growing chocolate cacao trees are currently Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana. They grow in tropical rainforests. And yeah, the sun cultivation means clearing the overstory of the trees, which is why it's bad, kind of clearing out the tree canopy and whatnot. The good news is they're mostly still small family farms, apparently. And it says here that the price of beans is low, leading to more. That doesn't make sense. But they're doing more intensive farming to meet the demand. If demand is high, the price is supposed to go up. So I'm not sure what's going on there. Maybe there's some kind of chocolate cartel or something, but yeah, capitalism not working like it's supposed to, as often happens.
I've seen documentaries that there is a chocolate cartel, that the companies that buy the raw chocolate from the farmers basically collude to keep the price for the beans low, and then they mark it up, thousands and thousands of percent before they sell it, before we can get a taste of it. So,
So yeah, the invisible hand is behind somebody's back with a couple of fingers crossed, is what's going on there. So that's chocolate. I don't really know, if you did this sh if you did it more sustainably, but these people really feel like they're making a choice, a case, I guess, for buying the more expensive organically produced cocoa and knowing where your beans from come from and stuff. So yeah, and then on Sunday we have a maple syrup. Maple syrup likes to grow in cold climates. The tree maple trees store starch in trunks and roots before the winter, and then in late winter, early spring, it comes up in the sap to spread out throughout the rest of the tree in the xylem sap, which there's xylem and phloem, two types of sap. The xylem tissue is designed to conduct water and nutrients from the roots to the stems and leaves. So that's it's only got the one job, and it's good at it. They're made from, let's see, sugar maples, red maples, and black maples, apparently, most commonly. Originally invented by the Northeastern Indigenous American peoples, settlers changed up their methods a little bit. Quebec is apparently the world's largest producer, coming up with 70% of the world's maple syrup. So, wow. Yeah, Quebec is really going to town there. Apparently different countries and states have different, everywhere it has to be have a certain level of sap content, but the sugar content varies from country to country and state to state, how much sugar it can have, sucrose it can have, and be called maple syrup or maple sugar, I guess. Interestingly, nobody really completely understands the chemistry that produces the unique taste. So that's why if you buy fake maple syrup, it tastes like crap. They don't know how to make the good stuff yet. It's used in baking as well as as a condiment, which is nice. Occasionally, you can also make it from box elder maples, big leaf maples, and Florida sugar maples. I think maybe it's harder and slower and stuff, but in a pinch, if you really, really want some, you can also get syrup from birch, maple, and palm trees if you're really determined. So I don't know how that'd be an interesting project. According to the USDA, most of the stuff I could find about maple trees and ecology is maple trees being affected by ecology. I think because they are so sort of delicate and fiddly in the process, is they've not developed an express route to make maple syrup ever. It's mostly they don't really lend themselves to plantation agriculture is what I'm getting at here. Maple trees are very sensitive to climate change, insects, drought, or freeze-thaw events, early frost, air pollution, invasive species, late frost, blah 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 blah. So it's likely in the future that climate change will move production north and shorten the sap collecting season, which is going to make it, you guessed it, even more expensive. It's already pretty expensive. Warmer temperatures, interestingly, tend to increase the amount of microbes and then clog the tap holes because there's too many microbes in them. Alrighty. Less winters are also going to mean less snow, and snow actually helps insulate the ground from freezing. So, yeah, ground freezing can kill roots and kill maple trees, which is bad. The longer growing season could mean more maple trees, though, so maybe it'll balance out, they're thinking. The sugar cr content apparently decreases with temperature rise, so there's that. Wind and ice storms also bad for maple trees, not great. And it can hurt. I found out what sugar bush means here. Sugar bush is apparently a stand of trees, originally native sugaring camps. So it's a stand of maple trees that produce sugar. So that's maple syrup. The future is looking grim. Enjoy it while you can, I guess. And yeah, that's just that alone is way worth pretty much, instituting completely changing our way of life for if we could get, yeah, French toast. My technician is having some kind of a seizure about French toast now.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That'd be terrible to lose French toast. But yeah,
There's life is not worth living without French toast and maple syrup.
maple syrup. Hear, hear.
We all know this.
My family, 1 year, our neighbors tapped a whole bunch of maple trees on our street that were in front of a graveyard. They didn't ask any permission, they just did it. And But they tapped them and they got a lot more sap than they could deal with. And so we also, since they had done it, we actually went and got some of that sap. And drinking the straight sap before it's boiled down into syrup, that was a really interesting taste. It was really very light and refreshing, and that was
Nice.
cool. And then we made maple syrup, just kept heating it up, and it turned into syrup. Unfortunately, the neighbors didn't know what they were doing, and they didn't seal up the holes they had made in the trees. And
Oh.
so they actually killed the whole stand of trees. And so yeah, they
Oopsie
are
doodle.
very delicate, and it's very,
Yeah.
you got to know what you're doing if you don't want to kill the trees. But yeah, I don't want to lose maple syrup, but yeah, the maples are being forced further north. So, all right. Well, thank you, Rebecca.
You're welcome.
And now we're going to go on to our ecological news. Our first story comes to us from the Santa Fe Mexican, Santa Fe New Mexican. It's a story on December 6th. And basically, it's a shameful story. U.S. House scraps proposal to expand radiation compensation to include New Mexico. And what this is there is a law that gives compensation to people who are suffering health effects like cancer and other diseases because fallout from nuclear testing, or you're working in uranium mines. And what happened was the House, under the current leadership, just essentially said no. The Senate had already passed this 61 to 37 way back in July. It's called RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. And so the Senate passed it because it just makes sense. If you're going to have all these people that suffered from the government's programs, to compensate them. And unfortunately, the Republicans disagreed and they killed it in the House. So this is pretty shameful. And the only reason I can think of is that they don't want to admit, they don't want to basically talk about, they don't want to take responsibility for the fact that all this radioactive stuff they've dredged up or created by bombs or through mines is dangerous. It is killing people. They want to just sort of pretend it doesn't. And so I think that's what was behind this shameful act by the US House. Okay, so we'll counter that with a little bit of good news. This is from the Houston Chronicle, a story by Dylan Bedore back on last week. And what's happened is Max Midstream has applied to put in a new refinery down there. And the Texas agency that's responsible for overseeing refineries and stuff said that they didn't have to have any public hearings, they didn't have to have any public information or any public input to the decision, because the ones who challenged it were shrimp fishermen who said that the shrimp fishery is going to be harmed. And the shrimp fishermen lived more than a mile away from the refinery. And Texas has had, it's not a rule because it was never put into any regulations, it's never been voted on, it's not in any law, but the agency had just sort of decided over the years that you have to live within a mile of any kind of development in order to have standing to complain about it. And so the refinery company depended on this and challenged it, and it got overturned to court. But this judge, this Travis County District Judge Amy Clark Meacham, she basically came on board and said, you know, this mile rule isn't based on anything except wanting to make it easier for polluters to pollute. So she
Does the pollution know it's not allowed to go more than a mile? From its source.
Yeah, I don't know if they tell it on its way out of the smokestack. You know, it's like, just stick around.
Yeah.
Don't go too far. Yeah.
Right.
No. So that's good news. So now there will be public hearing, and there'll be, a chance to talk about, the possible effects and on the fishery and all that sort of stuff. So that's good news. Now, on over to the UK. We rush over to the UK, and The Guardian has done a whole series of articles on the radioactive danger by the nuclear industry there. And they have a story revealed: Sellafield nuclear site has leak that could pose risk to public. And essentially, what they've got is this building that's housing tons and tons of radioactive sludge. And it's got 22 concrete silos. And what has happened is the radiation, it's so intensely radioactive that it is degrading the building. And essentially, now there's cracks showing up in the concrete and the asphalt that's supposed to contain this stuff. There's joints are breaking, and this sludge has wa radioactive water on top, and then this really nasty, think the bottom of your sump pump kind of stuff underneath that, and all of it can flow, and all of it is leaking out, and if it could get into the groundwater. And this stuff, this particular mixture of wastes, can have can release radiation into the atmosphere, and there could be explosions. And if there's
Whoa, explosions.
if there's explosions, Norway, which is downwind from Sellafield, thinks that there could be a plume of radioactive particles that could basically wipe out Norway's ability to grow food or
Whoa.
have wildlife. So there was a senior Norwegian official who talked to the Guardian, and they said that they should, Norway wants to step in and help run Sellafield because it's being run so badly
Yeah.
that they're afraid that they're gonna suffer the consequences. So just an interesting story, and this was hearkening back to our earlier discussion about sacrifice zones. An important,
Norway doesn't want to be one.
exactly. Nuclear is the only source of energy that can turn an entire country into a sacrifice zone. Next story, December 6th, Amy Goodman, who has a program called Democracy Now!, she interviewed a fella named Vladimir Slivyak, and he was co-chair of Russia's leading environmental organization called Eco-Defense. And he was talking about the fact that Russia and the US, oh, the title of the story is Why Are Russia and US Promoting Nuclear Power at UN Climate Talks? Russian Environmentalist Speaks Out. And basically, he's been forced to flee Russia because Vladimir Putin doesn't like environmentalists, and he has a habit of killing people he doesn't like. So he is operating. So this fella, Vladimir Slivyak, is operating from Germany, but he's saying very clearly, and here's a quote: "When you promote nuclear power, you have to understand it's diverting resources from renewable energy. And renewable energy is the real most efficient answer to climate change.
Right.
And Russia is profiting off of climate change because Russia, one of its main sources of income is selling natural gas to other countries. And another one of its main sources of income is selling uranium, selling nuclear power plant fuel. Russia, and the US are supposed to be at odds, but when it comes to nuclear energy, they were both pushing to have it put into the COP statement. And in fact, nuclear was listed in the final COP document, the final statement of all the parties. COP stands for Conference of Parties, and so the final statement broke new grounds in that it does finally, after 28 years, call for a phase out of fossil fuels. But then, unfortunately, it said, so we need to transition to other fuels like renewables. At least they listed renewables first. But then they listed right after renewables comes nuclear, and then transition fossil fuels like natural gas, like you're going from coal to natural gas, and then a whole string of other really terrible technologies that have no help, no chance of actually helping prevent climate change. Moving on, another story, how wind turbines could coexist peacefully with bats and birds. Story, November 8th by Katrina Zimmer in Knowable magazine. And this story basically, it's talking mostly about Australia, and they found that down in Australia, wind turbines kill about 4 to 6 birds per turbine per year. That's higher than most other studies. Most other studies around the world, meta studies show it's about 1 bird per turbine per year. But the focus of this story is that there are a number of things you can do, a number of technologies that will reduce that 4 to 6 per turbine per year even more. And they also talk about how bats, they found that ultrasonic noises, we actually proposed this several years ago on this show, that ultrasonic noises can scare bats away from wind turbines. Putting the bird and bat mortality in perspective, we're talking wind turbines kill like a tenth of a percent compared to things like cats and large buildings like skyscrapers.
Now let's talk about your car. Plenty of birds run into your car window, you know.
Yeah, but cars kill many more birds than wind turbines. So it's not perfect, the bird and bat kill is not zero, but there are technologies, and the wind industry has shown much more willingness to adapt to those technologies than many other industries, like nuclear industry, for example. So, all right, next on to the next story. This is another aspect, another positive feedback loop, unfortunately. This is a story in Yahoo News, December 10th. Estimated 2 billion tons of sand and dust are entering the atmosphere every year. We are in a vicious circle.
Uh-oh.
So basically, what's happening is a desertification. So more and more areas in places like Africa and Asia are turning into desert from grassland. And United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification did a report, and 25% of the storms, sandstorms, can be attributed to human activity like mining and grazing. And so what you get is this vicious circle where you mine or you overgraze and you create a dead area. And so then the winds come and pick up the dust from that dead area and create a sandstorm. And then that sandstorm covers area around it, wiping out the vegetation and increasing the size of the desert. And so then that creates an even larger area that you can pull your sand from for your sandstorm. And so the next sandstorm, is even bigger. And so we've got a positive feedback loop. And so there's things we can do, but controlling dust, land management, and there are examples. China had this exact problem with the Lazhou area, the Lazhou region, and they turned it around. They turned it from a dead, overgrazed area into what is now actually a lush and very productive agriculture area that has zero sandstorms. They used to have sandstorms every year. Well, thanks so much. This is Joe DeMar.
And Rebecca Wood.
We are signing off.